Welcome back to the Deep Dive. And today is a massive milestone, not just for us sitting here in the studio, but for the actual subject of the story we're about to wrap up.
Yeah, it really is. Because it is 2026, which incredibly marks exactly 25 years since the foundation of Wolf Architects.
I mean, a quarter of a century. We're talking 25 years of pushing boundaries, redefining spaces, and fundamentally putting the art back into architecture.
Yeah.
And today, we're bringing you part three, the dramatic, incredibly climactic, and honestly surprisingly emotional finale of our deep dive into the completely unconventional blueprint of how Terrace Wolfe actually became an architect.
It's such a huge milestone, and our mission for today's dive is to really explore the psychology of what happens when a wild, rebellious 15-year detour finally hits a solid brick wall. We are going to look closely at the humbling, often deeply uncomfortable act of returning home to an original calling.
Right.
And we'll examine how the invisible forces of destiny seem to guide us, but, and this is the crucial part, only when we actively participate in our own lives.
Okay, so before we get into the wild resolution of this story, we need to do a rapid-fire recap of parts one and two. I am setting a literal timer here in the studio, strictly under 5 minutes, because there is just a monumental amount of ground to cover today.
Good call.
But hey, if you, the listener, haven't heard parts one and two yet, do yourself a massive favor. Pause this deep dive right now. Go back and listen to them. There are so many hilarious, unbelievable stories and profound pearls of wisdom you are missing out on. Seriously, go back. We'll wait.
Yeah, the context is absolutely everything with this journey. You really can't appreciate the return if you don't fully understand the escape.
Exactly. So for those of you all caught up, or those who just love jumping straight into the deep end of the pool, here is the breathless recap of how we arrived at this exact moment. We started with Tardas growing up as a profoundly lonely but wildly imaginative kid in Thailand.
Right, a boy who spoke Thai before he spoke English, playing alone, inventing entire worlds with paper and glue.
Yeah, and buying professional, high-end drafting pens with his pocket money at the age of 10, which is just amazing.
His mind was constantly operating on a frequency of spatial design, which unfortunately meant his mind was absolutely never focused on his standard academic schoolwork.
Which gets him promptly shipped off to a prestigious, highly rigid boarding school in Singapore United World College. This is where he has to battle his lifelong, terrifying nemesis, algebra.
Oh, the dreaded algebra.
He barely survives the academic gauntlet by finding a physical sanctuary in a craft design and technology class. There he goes head-to-head in a fierce, hyper-competitive rivalry with the school's golden boy, Michael Liu.
And that specific rivalry pushes Terrace to design this massive, mind-blowing house built entirely around a giant living tree for his major project.
Hold that thought. That treehouse concept is a detail we definitely need to keep heavily pinned to the board for later today.
Oh, absolutely. Keep a giant, glowing pin in that tree.
So Terrace evolves into a rebellious teenager, actively fighting rigid teachers, dodging advanced algebra like his actual life depends on it, and eventually throwing himself at the university system in Australia.
Where he miraculously talks his way into a special, unprecedented 93rd spot at the University of Melbourne.
Based purely on his unbelievable visual portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
He bypasses the traditional high school grades completely. He effectively outruns the math.
But just when you think he has permanently hacked the system, the bureaucracy bites back.
Oh, it bites back with zero mercy. He finishes his undergraduate degree with straight A's, goes to get a standard run-of-the-mill exemption for practical experience so he can immediately start his master's, and the dean of the faculty, Haid Beck, a man famous for his signature bow tie who had previously praised Terrace's work, looks him dead in the eye and flat-out denies him.
And we know how Terrace handles arbitrary authority.
He goes nuclear. He takes his hard-earned undergraduate degree, strikes a match, and literally burns it to ashes on a barbecue. He walks away from architecture completely.
Just an incredible pivot.
Right. He morphs into a professional Latin dancer. He becomes the undefeated champion of Southeast Asia. He builds a stunning minimalist dance school by the river in Bangkok. He deals with massive family business nightmares, moves back to Melbourne, sleeps freezing on a friend's balcony, hustles vintage Star Wars toys just to survive, and throws a massive, wild dance party where he meets the absolute love of his life, a medical student named Rebecca.
I mean, it is genuinely exhausting just listening to the itinerary of that 15-year detour. And this raises an important question. How does a guy who literally torched his degree just walk back into the university?
Exactly. The romantic, starving artist, world champion dancer phase is suddenly violently colliding with adulthood reality. But to understand how he goes back, we actually have to rewind to a crucial what-if moment from his undergraduate years, don't we?
We do, because to understand the psychological architecture of his return, we have to look at a moment that set this entire chaotic sequence of events into motion.
Yeah, let's look at that.
It happened during the third year of his undergrad. At that time, Taras was an absolute machine. He was pulling straight A's. He was designing these highly controversial, hyper-minimalist spaces, receiving immense support from his tutor, Alex Selenich. He felt untouchable.
Untouchable, yeah.
Until, out of nowhere, he receives a B on a single assignment.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because for most students, a B is a cause for celebration. You know, you go to the pub. But for a perfectionist operating on a singular, exhausting obsession with architecture, a B is a full-blown existential crisis.
Absolutely.
And here is where it gets crazy. Taras looked at this B, and he knew with absolute certainty that it was a mistake. He was incredibly confident that if he simply submitted it for reassessment, it would be revised up to an A. It was highly likely an anomaly, maybe even a simple administrative error by a teaching assistant.
Yeah, a simple clerical thing.
All he had to do was walk into an office and file a standard appeal.
Right.
Why on earth didn't he?
What's fascinating here is the psychology behind that specific pause. Because instead of fighting it, which was his standard operating procedure up to that point, a very quiet voice deep inside Taras told him to just let it be.
Wow.
He had this profound, sudden realization that his ego should not be so incredibly fragile that a single letter grade on a piece of paper could wound his pride to that extent. He was forced to take a macro-level step back and look at his life.
Right.
He realized architecture had become a monopolizing force. He was operating with this exhausting, unhealthy obsession, and he desperately needed balance before he completely burned out.
And this is where Taras introduces this beautiful, slightly mystical philosophy that I just love. He looks back at that moment and asks himself, was it an angle that gave him the B, some sort of skewed perspective from a grader, or was it an angel actively asking him to reflect?
It's a really compelling concept. This idea of the spirit world or invisible forces quietly intervening in our daily lives. Taras genuinely believes that what we perceive as roadblocks, administrative errors, and even antagonistic players in our lives are very often angels in disguise.
Angels in disguise.
Exactly. They are structural interventions designed to push us off a path that is perhaps moving too fast or lacks the necessary dimensionality and onto the one we are actually meant to navigate.
Let's just look at the serendipity engineering of that one. Yeah. Single B grade. Because he decides not to fight it, he decides he needs to immediately find balance outside of the architectural studio. So he takes himself out to a movie theater alone and he watches Strictly Ballroom.
Yep.
That movie fundamentally captivates him, so much so that he enrolls in a local dance school. That single dance class eventually snowballs into him becoming a professional dancer, which leads him to throw that massive party years later, which is exactly where he meets his soulmate, his future wife, Rebecca.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is staggering to think about the alternative timelines. If he had marched into that office, appealed that grade, and gotten his A, he likely would have just kept his head down in the studio.
Yeah, nose to the grindstone.
He would have stayed completely unhealthily obsessed with architecture, gone straight through the academic system, maybe taken a junior corporate job overseas, or gone to a different university entirely for his postgraduate studies. He never would have stepped onto a dance floor. He never would have thrown that party. He never would have met Rebecca.
It really makes you stop and think about your own life, doesn't it? Like, think about it. What are the fateful B grades you've received? The closed doors, the rejected job applications, the missed flights that felt like infuriating setbacks at the time, but actually forced you to take a detour that fundamentally changed the trajectory of your entire existence.
We can think of it as the architecture of detours. You can never see the master blueprint when you're standing in the middle of the construction site. You only see the mud and the scaffolding.
That's a great way to put it. So fast forward, the detour has been wild. It's been global. But now Taras is nearing 30 years old. The romanticism of the journey is fading. And the reality check is hitting him like a ton of bricks.
Right, because he has to finally admit to himself that he is not going to reach his ultimate sky-high goal of becoming a world champion dancer. He's good, he was the undisputed best in Southeast Asia, but The absolute top tier, the global elite, is slipping away due to time and physical limits.
Yeah, that's a tough pill to swallow.
You really have to imagine the intense psychological ego hit of that realization. Terrace had spent over a decade trying to prove to everyone, and mostly to himself, that he could be a massive, undeniable success without the establishment.
He wanted to show the academic world that he didn't need their piece of paper to be extraordinary.
But now the dust is settling, and he's looking around at his peers who stayed in the architecture program. They've been walking the straight, boring, predictable line. And because of that, they are advancing in their reputable careers, making substantial money, buying houses, gaining real societal stability.
And contrast that with Terrace. He is 30 years old, running a small, scrappy building design business called Wolf Designs out of his living room, completely unable to legally call himself an architect, and feeling this crushing embarrassment that he has so little tangible stability to show for his wild, maverick life.
It's a profoundly humbling reality because the context of his life has shifted. The stakes are completely different now. He's no longer just a rebellious kid trying to stick it to a dean in a bow tie. He has Rebecca.
Right. And she is an incredibly smart, driven doctor.
He deeply wants to build a family with her, to have children, and to provide for that family in the way he envisions. He realizes that being an uncredentialed building designer has a hard, impenetrable ceiling. He needs to become a credible, legally registered architect.
He actually jokes about it, saying, Mummy is a doctor, so Dad should be something highly credible like an architect. But there is real truth beneath that joke.
There is. He has to deploy cold, hard logic. He has to swallow this immense pride and accept what, at the time, felt like a bitter, comprehensive defeat. By going back, he felt like he was conceding to the establishment that he was wrong to leave in the first place.
So here is where it gets incredibly funny, but also deeply frustrating.
Yeah.
He makes the decision. He's doing it. He's going back to get his master's. So he sits down at his computer to apply online. Remember, it's been years. Systems are completely digitized now. And the computer system basically evaluates his scattered, non-traditional profile and spits out a giant red error message.
The great unfeeling digital firewall. Modern bureaucratic algorithms are entirely designed to process predictable linear paths. Mm. They punish unconventional human journeys.
It's hilarious, but you feel for him. Mm. He doesn't fit neatly into any standard drop-down menu. The system flags him as a mature age student, which triggers a protocol requiring him to take this massive, drawn-out, painful foundational pathway just to prove he belongs back in the classroom.
It's insulting to a guy who already runs a design business.
Exactly. And, oh yeah, he has a tiny, microscopic problem regarding the prerequisite documentation. He can't upload a PDF copy of his undergraduate degree because he literally burned the original to ashes in a fit of rage on a barbecue.
You can vividly picture him staring at the glowing screen. The irony is so thick you could carve it. He has finally, painfully wrestled his ego into submission. He is ready to surrender to the system, and the system's automated algorithm rejects his surrender because he doesn't have the right paperwork.
But wait, this is Terrace Wolf. He doesn't just sit there and accept a digital no. This is the third major time in his life he's faced a stubbornly stuck administrative door.
First, it was the boarding school in Singapore trying to force him into algebra.
Then it was the University of Melbourne initially rejecting his high school grades. Now it's the digital portal. And he realizes something profound about himself in this moment. He isn't stressed. He isn't throwing a tantrum. His deep-rooted creativity just quietly kicks into gear.
This brings up a crucial point about how Terrace views destiny versus free will. He believes in angels and invisible forces, yes. But he never, ever just passively trusts destiny to do the work for him. He is a highly active participant.
He doesn't just wait around.
Right. He believes you have to act with conviction. If the algorithmic system blocks the front door, you use your imagination to find a physical window. You engineer your own serendipity.
So he completely bypasses the online portal. He just closes the laptop. He physically drives down to the campus of the University of Melbourne. He walks right back into the exact same faculty building he stormed out of years ago.
Talk about walking into the lion's den.
Right, and he just starts wandering down those familiar, echoing corridors, knocking on heavy wooden office doors, hoping to find a real, breathing human being who has the authority to override a computer program. And who does he miraculously find sitting behind one of those doors?
Dr. Jeff Turnbull.
The exact same man who created the miraculous 93rd spot for him when he was an unproven teenager fresh out of high school.
The stochastic resonance of that moment is incredible. Of all the offices, of all the times. And Jeff Turnbull remembers him instantly. Because to Jeff, Taras wasn't just another face in a crowded lecture hall. He was the prodigy who actually justified the massive administrative gamble they took by letting him in without the math prerequisites years ago.
Kara sits down in the chair opposite Jeff. He is feeling incredibly vulnerable, feeling like a defeated prodigal son, and he explains this whole chaotic situation, the dancing, the detours, the lack of a physical degree, the computer blocking his enrollment.
Yeah, laying it all out.
And Jeff Turnbull gives him exactly the psychological encouragement he desperately needed. Jeff completely validates the journey. He tells Taras that these wild, real-world experiences, building things in Thailand, negotiating with clients, running a business, aren't a setback. They are a massive, undeniable asset.
You can imagine how that validation effectively erases years of Taras's internal self-doubt in a single 30-minute conversation.
And it gets even better. Jeff stands up and walks Taras down the hall to meet Dr. Greg Missingham, who was the head of architecture at the time. Taras sits with Greg and starts meticulously describing the minimalist dance school he designed and physically built by the river in Bangkok.
And we need to emphasize this. This wasn't just a hypothetical student project made of balsa wood and hot glue. This was a physical, functioning, highly sophisticated building contending with tropical weather, structural loads, and commercial budgets.
Right. It was real.
Greg Missingham is a pragmatist. He is so blown away by the level of precision, the understanding of materiality, and the sheer maturity of the design that he immediately calls in his associate to look at the portfolio.
And who is the associate that walks through the door? Alex Selenich, the exact same tutor who fiercely supported Taras's controversial avant-garde minimalist designs back in his second year of his undergrad.
The band is entirely back together.
It's amazing. And Greg and Alex look at Taras, they look at his extensive real-world portfolio, and Greg says, very practically, you do not really need to do this course. What you need is to be a registered architect as soon as possible.
It's a beautiful moment of academic clarity. They recognize that forcing a guy who has literally poured concrete and erected commercial structures to sit through a standard step-by-step academic curriculum meant for 22-year-olds is an absurd waste of everyone's time.
Exactly.
So they flex their administrative muscles. They make an executive decision right there in the room. They officially award Taras 100 credit points specifically for his real-world experience.
Which instantly cuts his required master's degree time from 2 agonizing years down to just 1 single year. He went from staring at a computer screen telling him he was a mature age liability who had to start from scratch to walking out of that building with half his master's degree already completed before he even officially enrolled.
And the grudge he held against the university is completely, utterly gone. He is officially back.
He is back. However, stepping back onto that campus full time brought a really complex, heavy wave of emotions. The administration might have welcomed him, but he still had to interact with the broader ecosystem. He has to swallow a massive amount of pride daily.
Yeah, let's talk about his first few days back on the actual grounds, because he's walking across the quad and he runs into a former peer, a guy who had studied right alongside him, sitting in the exact same classes during his undergrad days.
But this peer isn't lugging a backpack full of textbooks anymore. He's a teacher at the university.
This is a massive real-time psychological test for Taras.
It really is. A younger, more arrogant Taras might have felt immense toxic jealousy or bitterness. The internal monologue could have easily been, I'm vastly more creative than you. Why are you the esteemed teacher while I'm back here as a lowly student asking for permission to design?
Right, the ego could have flared up.
But Taras notes this incredible, quiet, emotional maturity taking over. He looks at his former peer and he feels nothing but genuine admiration.
He respects the straight line. He recognizes that while his own path was chaotic, passionate, and full of extreme highs and lows, there is profound, undeniable value in the path his peer took. That guy put in the consistent, unglamorous, traditional academic work, and he earned the right to teach at a prestigious institution.
And Taras just smiles, warmly congratulates him, and completely shrugs off any lingering ego. It's a moment of deep identity foreclosure being resolved.
But that was just the warm-up exercise for his ego, because later that week, the campus delivers the ultimate jaw-dropping encounter.
Yes. Taras is walking along the corridor, and he sees him, the man in the signature bow tie.
Dean Hagbeck.
The very man who cold-bloodedly denied his exemption. Yeah. The man who caused Taras to burn his degree on a barbecue, quit his job, and leave the entire architectural industry for over a decade. the literal architect of his misery, you could say.
What's fascinating here is how Taurus handles this confrontation, because you have to wonder what's going through his head in the 3 seconds it takes to close the distance between them. Is the righteous anger going to violently flare up? Is he going to demand a belated apology? Is he going to smugly rub his new real-world success in the dean's face?
Right. Any of those reactions would be understandable. But he walks right up to the dean, and the dean visibly braces himself. He looks at this guy, still rocking a long ponytail, and you can practically see the cogs turning in Beck's head. He's trying to place the face, trying to recall the exact, highly contentious circumstances of their last meeting.
He finally remembers this highly ambitious, furious kid he denied years ago. Beck is absolutely expecting a hostile confrontation. He's likely preparing his academic defense.
Instead, a profound, disarming sense of calm washes over Taurus. He extends his hand, shakes the dean's hand warmly, and simply says, "I want to thank you."
It's such a phenomenally powerful moment of emotional alchemy, transforming deep resentment into pure gratitude.
It's mind-blowing. Taurus actually takes the time to explain to him that because Beck denied him that exemption, he was violently forced onto a detour that ultimately gave him the absolute best things in his entire life. He tells him about his best friend Paul Green, his beautiful family, his incredible wife Rebecca, and these incredibly unique spatial creative skills he gained from years of dancing.
Taurus realizes in that exact moment, standing in the hallway, that if Beck had just lazily rubber-stamped his application and let him through the gate, his life would have been terrifyingly narrow and flat.
Yeah, totally.
He would have just been another competent architect in a sea of competent architects. Beck's internal motivations for denying him back then, whether it was professional spite, a strict, unyielding adherence to bureaucratic rules, or even genuinely thinking Taurus was arrogant and needed a break, none of it matters anymore.
No, it really doesn't.
The source of the friction is irrelevant. The pearl it created is what matters. The grudge simply evaporates into the air.
Beck is visibly moved. He just gives him a warm smile and says, "I do remember you, Taurus, and it is very nice to have you back." That short, quiet conversation gives Taurus the ultimate closure. He's not running away anymore, and he's not actively fighting the system. He's finally home.
But being home and being at peace with the institution doesn't mean the actual process was easy. In fact, it was a logistical waking nightmare.
Okay, let's unpack the actual master's degree year.
I know.
Because the irony of his academic return is hilarious. The actual coursework, the theoretical design assignments, they were an absolute breeze for Taurus.
Of course they were. He had spent years running his own business, designing real buildings, negotiating with stubborn clients, and managing actual unforgiving construction budgets. A theoretical university assignment with no real-world gravity or financial constraints was a walk in the park. He was running absolute circles around the curriculum. He was actually held up by the older professors as the prime example of how we used to do things in the old days because he had such remarkably strong hand-drawing skills, whereas all the younger students were entirely reliant on computers.
So the coursework wasn't the mountain he had to climb. The mountain was his daily punishing schedule. Because he isn't just a student living in a dorm. He's actively running a rapidly growing architectural business, Wolf Designs. He has actual paying clients calling him during lectures.
Yeah, that's wild.
And on top of that, he is a dedicated father to a young daughter and a husband to a doctor with her own intense schedule.
So he is agonizingly juggling full-time, demanding university studies, running a profitable studio, and trying to be a present, engaged father and husband. Finding the physical hours in the day was completely bone-deep exhausting. He was constantly context-switching between academic theory and brutal business reality.
But out of this exhaustion, there's this beautiful, unexpected, symbiotic relationship he develops with the younger students in his cohort. Whenever there was group work, all the young kids desperately wanted to partner with Taurus. Why? Because he had the real-world, practical experience. They knew he could take their wild, avant-garde, structurally impossible concepts and ground them into something actually buildable.
Exactly. When a 22-year-old designs a massive, floating, cantilevered roof made of glass, Taurus is the guy who says, "Okay, brilliant concept. Now, where are the load-bearing columns? How are we hiding the HVAC system? What is the thermal mass doing in the summer? And how does this fit within a realistic client budget?" He brought gravity to their theory.
And in return for this dose of reality, the younger students taught Taurus the absolute latest design software and 3D modeling programs, which he had completely missed out on during his years touring as a dancer. They acted as his tech support, which saved him precious, irreplaceable time and helped him survive that intense daily juggling act.
It's a genuinely great dynamic, a perfect exchange of generational knowledge. Until the power-tripping academic tutor enters the chat.
Oh, there's always one.
Always. Academia is unfortunately ripe for people who enjoy wielding small amounts of power over others.
So Terrace has assigned this specific tutor who seems to have a massive, inexplicable chip on her shoulder. She knows perfectly well that Terrace already runs his own highly successful private practice. And for whatever twisted reason, she decides she needs to assert her academic dominance over him.
Yeah, she marks him as a target.
She actively looks for reasons to fail his assignments, picking apart his highly functional work with terrible, baseless, purely subjective critiques.
But you have to remember who she is dealing with. Terrace is a 30-year-old business owner who has dealt with real-world contractors and zoning boards. He isn't intimidated by a university tutor. He knows exactly how good and how structurally sound his work is. So during class, in front of everyone, he just calmly, methodically, and logically dismantles her critiques. He shoots down her arguments without ever raising his voice or losing his temper.
Which, of course, drives her absolutely crazy, because a bully desperately wants an emotional reaction.
Yeah.
He's just giving her cool, impenetrable logic. But then the turning point happens. The tutor realizes she absolutely cannot break Terrace. So she pivots her strategy and starts targeting a younger, more vulnerable female student in the class.
It's a textbook case of displacement of aggression. If you can't beat the strong target, you crush the weak one to prove you still have power.
Precisely. She starts bullying this young girl relentlessly, tearing apart her designs in front of the class, reducing her to tears, and actively threatening her with an entirely unjustified failing grade. And this is where Terrace officially draws the line.
If we connect this back to his teenage years, this is the exact same psychological profile of the guy who stood up to his towering IB physics teacher in Bangkok when that teacher tried to unfairly deregister him just to maintain class averages.
Right, that sense of justice.
Terrace has a lifelong ingrained reflex against rigid, unfair authority figures abusing their power. He wasn't going to let this fly for a second.
It's not a chance. He knows the younger student's entire academic future. Her confidence, her career, is hanging in the balance. But he's older now. He doesn't cause a massive screaming match in the middle of the studio. He's deeply strategic. He quietly comforts the girl afterwards, tells her her work is excellent, and then he takes the matter straight to the top of the food chain.
He bypasses the middleman.
He walks directly into Dr. Greg Missingham's office and formally reports the tutor.
He lays out exactly objectively what is happening in that classroom. Missingham, being a true leader, immediately pulls and reviews both Terrace's and the young girl's portfolios. He quickly and definitively confirms that their designs are not only sound, but excellent and absolutely nowhere near the failing grades the tutor was threatening.
Missingham instantly recognizes how incredibly toxic and legally precarious the situation is. So he pulls Terrace and the young student completely out of that tutor's class on the spot. And the kicker, that toxic tutor never taught a class at the University of Melbourne ever again.
It's a fantastic, satisfying resolution to a bullying situation. But the real enduring blessing in disguise here is what happens next. Because Missingham takes Terrace and the student directly under his own personal, intensive mentorship.
Because of this awful conflict, Terrace gets to spend his final year working one-on-one with the head of architecture. Missingham gets an up-close, unfiltered, daily look at exactly how Terrace's mind works. He sees the spatial genius, the deep practicality, the unique real-world asset that Terrace is.
And that high-level mentorship leads Terrace to graduate his master's degree with first-class honors. He finally, officially gets the piece of paper he burned on a barbecue a decade earlier.
And the faculty loves him so much, they're so impressed by his synthesis of theory and practice, that they immediately invite him back to teach. They even strongly suggest he should stick around the university and do a PhD.
To which Terrace, politely but firmly, says absolutely not.
He literally laughs out loud. He thinks to himself, thank God, no more formal education, no more theoretical papers, and absolutely no more chance of running into advanced algebra ever again. He is completely done with the academic world.
But getting the master's degree isn't the final boss of this journey. We have to clarify that for the listener because the architectural profession is incredibly strict. In architecture, a master's degree just means you graduated from a school. It does not legally make you an architect. You cannot put that word on your business card yet.
To legally use the coveted title architect, you have to pass the grueling, notoriously difficult, deeply intimidating three-step registration process.
It is a massive, multi-tiered hurdle designed to weed people out. First, you have to complete a comprehensive, heavily scrutinized logbook of your professional hours, proving you've touched every single phase of a building's creation.
Yeah, that takes forever.
Then you have to pass a rigorous, exhausting written exam covering everything from contract law to structural engineering. And finally, the most terrifying part, you have to sit before a live panel of highly established veteran architects for an oral examination.
Oh man, the panel.
They grill you mercilessly on building codes, professional ethics, liability, contracts, everything. There is nowhere to hide in that room.
So Taurus goes through the gauntlet. He submits the dense logbook. He sits for the grueling written exam. He walks into the paneled room and faces the live tribunal of veteran architects. And then he just has to wait. The tension is immense, almost suffocating. This is the absolute culmination of his entire life's ambition, dating back when he was 10 years old buying drafting pens. The detour is over. The schooling is over. The exams are over. It all comes down to a single envelope in the mail.
And then the final envelope arrives in his mailbox.
He opens it. He reads the verdict. He passed.
You really have to picture the cinematic, almost overwhelming climax of this exact moment. Taurus is standing outside in the front yard of a stunning modern house he personally designed and built for his own family. He reads the letter. The crushing weight of a 15-year journey licks off his shoulders. The relief washes over him, and he literally falls backward.
He's lying flat out on the grass, staring straight up at the blue sky, screaming in pure, unfiltered elation to the heavens. He finally did it.
But here is the specific detail that is just mind-blowing, the detail that ties this entire three-part epic together. As he's lying there on the grass, catching his breath, his heart pounding, he looks straight up. And what is he looking at? He is looking up through the sprawling, complex branches of a massive Chinese elm tree.
Wow.
A tree that he had purposefully, painstakingly planted right in the exact center of his property years earlier, designing the entire flow of his home around its eventual canopy.
Oh man, this gives me absolute chills every time I think about it.
Mm. If we connect this to the bigger picture decades earlier, as a profoundly lonely 13-year-old kid trapped at a strict boarding school in Singapore, desperately trying to escape the nightmare of algebra, what did he draw for his major CDT portfolio project to save his grades?
He conceptualized and beautifully drew a house built entirely to protect and embrace a massive living tree growing right through the exact middle of it.
He wasn't just drawing a school assignment back then. He was literally manifesting his own future reality. And now, decades later, after burning degrees, after dancing across continents, after facing down academic bullies and digital firewalls, he is lying under that exact canopy he dreamed up as a child, holding the paper that officially makes him an architect.
That is just unbelievable.
In that beautiful, quiet moment beneath the Chinese elm tree, the scrappy Wolf Designs officially sheds its old skin, and Wolf Architects is officially born.
The interconnectedness of it all is staggering. The poetry of that moment is unmatched. Which brings us to a huge philosophical question we need to ask. Was the massive 15-year detour a waste of time? Was it just a prolonged delay tactic driven by ego and fear of the establishment?
Absolutely not. And this is where the core philosophy of Wolf Architects really crystallizes and separates them from other firms. Taurus looks back and realizes that the highly specific skills he honed on the professional Latin dance floor became the exact, undeniable foundation of his architectural practice.
Explain that connection for me. How does dancing the rumba or the cha-cha translate to designing physical buildings made of steel and glass?
It's all fundamentally about movement, spatial awareness, and partnership. Taurus actually teaches his architectural staff to think about the choreography, flow, and rhythm of a space. A building isn't just a static dead box. It's a dynamic space that human beings move through.
Okay, I see.
It has a tempo. Think about a long, narrow, dimly lit hallway. It forces a fast pace. It hurries you along. Now think about a wide, sun-drenched atrium. It slows you down. It invites you to pause. Taurus designs buildings the way a choreographer designs a routine. He uses light as a dance partner. He ensures the rooms transition smoothly without jarring interruptions in the rhythm.
That is brilliant. And the partnering aspect is huge too, right? Taurus learned early on in his career that a bad dance lead is someone who just selfishly shows off their fancy, complicated moves, totally ignoring their partner's skill level, leaving their partner confused, off balance, and making them both look ridiculous on the floor.
A great architect, just like a great dance lead, knows how to truly listen, interpret, and partner with their client. a bad architect, and there are many of them, designs a building just to show off to other architects, to win shiny awards, or to be published in a magazine.
Yeah, we've all seen those buildings.
They leave the actual client to live in a confusing, unlivable, leaky monument to the architect's own ego. Tars learned on the dance floor that his singular job is to make his partner, the client, the star of the show. If the client feels safe, completely understood, and elevated by the space, then the architecture is a resounding success.
So that 15-year detour wasn't a distraction at all. It was his true master-level education. It's exactly how he put the art, the humanity, and the movement back into architecture.
And he finally gets to proudly display his hard-earned credentials to prove it. But there's one final incredibly funny anecdote about that process of displaying his degrees.
Oh, the statutory declaration. I absolutely love this detail. So Tars is officially legally registered. He wants to proudly hang his hard-earned master's degree on the wall of his beautiful new studio. But he decides it would be a really poetic, full-circle moment to have his original undergraduate degree hanging right next to it.
The same undergraduate degree he literally turned into a bonfire years ago.
Mm-hmm. The very one. So he contacts the University of Melbourne administration and politely requests a reissued print of his undergrad degree. But, as we know, bureaucracy never changes. The administration tells him that to get an official reprint, he has to fill out a statutory declaration form.
A legally binding document.
Right, signed under penalty of perjury, explaining exactly, in detail, what happened to the original piece of paper.
You can just imagine him sitting at his beautifully designed desk, pen in hand, trying to figure out how to concisely explain his angry, anti-establishment, 20-something-year-old self to a modern, humorless bureaucratic system.
So what does he do? He keeps it incredibly, hilariously brief. On this formal legal document, he just writes three simple words, "It got burnt."
Conveniently omitting the crucial detail that he was the one actively holding the match.
Yeah, it just combusted, you know, spontaneous academic combustion. Crazy things happen. And the amazing part is the university accepts it. Today, both of those degrees sit proudly framed together in his studio. They aren't symbols of frustration or rigid authority anymore. They are the physical, tangible markers of this wild, beautifully interconnected, perfectly orchestrated journey.
It's the perfect time to summarize the philosophy of this entire saga, to look at the what-ifs of the universe. What if he hadn't been a terrible, distracted student in Bangkok, his parents wouldn't have shipped him to the boarding school in Singapore, and he never would have discovered the sanctuary of the CDT classroom?
And what if he had passed that RMIT entrance exam? He might have quietly settled for his backup plan instead of demanding his rightful place at Melbourne Uni and getting that 93rd spot.
What if he never got that fateful B grade? Or what if he had just appealed it like a normal student?
The interconnectedness is staggering. The cascade of seemingly negative events producing immensely positive outcomes. But Tars is very careful to remind us that we shouldn't just look back at our lives and say, oh, it was all simply meant to be. That's far too passive. It strips you of your agency?
You have to be an active player in your own destiny. You have to engineer the serendipity. Tars' career as an architect does not define him entirely. Knowing him just as an architect or just as a dancer would be a very limited, flat dimension of the man. It's just one branch on the massive, complex tree of his life.
Right.
He finally outran algebra, yes. But he didn't do it by fighting it head-on or suddenly studying hard and becoming a math genius. He did it by creatively, relentlessly navigating around it. He used his immense imagination to bypass closed doors and algorithmic firewalls. He took decisive, sometimes reckless action.
He sure did.
The dance of life is a constant, intricate partnership between what is strictly within your control, your free will, your effort, your creativity, and trusting the invisible forces, the angels and angles that might be guiding you toward your true center.
What an absolute emotional roller coaster this has been. From a lonely kid drawing tanks and submarines in Thailand, to the undefeated Latin dance champion of Southeast Asia, to falling backward onto the grass under a Chinese elm tree as a legally registered visionary architect.
It really leaves us with a deeply provocative thought to chew on. Look at your own life right now in this exact moment. What are the fateful B grades or the closed administrative doors that you are currently cursing and fighting against? Are they actually angels in disguise, actively trying to change your rhythm and push you onto a better path?
That's a powerful question.
And perhaps more importantly, is there a perfectly laid, highly sensible blueprint in your life right now that you might need to creatively burn to ashes in order to figure out who you are truly meant to be?
Wow. Burn the blueprint to find yourself. I think that's the perfect note to end on. Well, that officially closes the chapter on how Terrace Wolf became an architect, but let me tell you, this is just the prologue.
Oh, absolutely.
The insane, global, wildly successful story of actually building Wolf Architects into what it is today in 2026. The high-end, demanding clients, the massive global logistical challenges, the incredible growth of the studio, the way they integrate that dance philosophy into multi-million dollar projects. That is a massive, sprawling story full of entirely new branches for another day. You're absolutely not going to want to miss that. Until next time, keep looking for the art in your own architecture.